You're listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, where you get valuable information you just can't find anywhere else. To thrive in today's trying times, you need the Financial Survival Network, now more than ever. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and get your free newsletter and gift. Financial Survival Network, now more than ever.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz, and today is 9/9/21. Well, you've probably heard this term kicked around in the news. You've seen it. It's always there, but you probably don't have much idea of what it's really about. Talking about private equity, and we are really fortunate to have an expert in private equity with us right now, Adam Coffey. That's Adam E. Coffey. And you can find him at adamecoffee.com. Well, Adam, I know you're going to give us a little education here on what private equity is about. For those of you who have a question, love to hear from you. Email us, kl@carrielutz.com. So private equity, what does that term really mean? And we should say that you're a best-selling author and you've developed companies and sold them off to private equity. So you're somebody who knows from whence they speak.
Hey, Carrie, nice to be here. Welcome to all your listeners, and thanks for tuning in. So yeah, I'm Adam Coffey. I've spent the last 20 years building three national service companies for a multitude of private equity sponsors. And you know, this is you know, we all have our niche in life, and this is happens to be my niche. So have built multiple businesses as big as billion-dollar companies with private equity sponsors. So essentially, when I get asked the question, what's private equity? I usually go to the analogy of a mutual fund. Everybody on the planet listening to your show certainly knows what a mutual fund is. Bunch of people go hop on their E-Trade account, you know, Ameritrade, whatever it is, Schwab, and they pick out a mutual fund. They can make an investment, and you have liquidity. A mutual fund manager aggregates the money of many investors, and then they pick what to buy, what to sell, what to hold, and everybody kind of rides the coattails of the mutual fund manager. You can buy it today, sell it tomorrow, hold it for 10 years, total liquidity. Private equity kind of works the same way. There's a few differences. So the first is typically the minimum investment size is 5 million. So for most private equity firms and funds, that means their biggest limited partners or investors are going to be pension funds, university endowment funds, or very wealthy people who are seeking to diversify their assets. And so private equity does exactly what it says. It invests in private companies. There's different flavors, different kinds of private equity funds. The most popular that people know is the VC fund because of TV shows and people like Mark Cuban. You know, everybody knows what a VC fund is, but that's not the biggest area of private equity. The biggest area is actually buyout funds, and buyout funds focus on buying established companies, growing them, and then selling them. A private equity charter is about 10 years. So a fund exists for about 10 years. You commit $5 million to it, as a minimum investment. And over the first few years of the fund, the firm is out looking at companies and they're buying companies and making capital calls, and you're sending in your pro rata portion, of the total fund size based on your investment, and companies are being bought. And then in the middle years, they're growing them, they're improving operations, they're doing mergers and acquisitions. And then later in the fund's gestation, they are then selling the funds in order to return the capital to the investors. And so the big difference between private equity and a mutual fund is liquidity. And then the second is, of course, minimum investment size. But essentially, private equity is a private mutual fund where big investors tie up money for up to 10 years at a time in order to get what hopefully is an outsized return. And over about a 30-year period that private equity has really been exploding, typical is to average about double the return of the S&P 500. And because of that performance, money continues to flow in, new firms continue to be founded, and the game continues.
Hasn't a lot of dumb money come into private equity where, oh, gee, it looks so easy. And then you have like hedge funds buying casinos that they know nothing about in Atlantic City, watching it go bankrupt. There's been some spectacular private equity failures over the past 10 years, hasn't there?
There has certainly been some, and that's really a result of all this capital, you know, now over $4.5 trillion in capital, you know, in assets under management in the private equity space. Right now, today, this very second, there's $1.5 trillion in dry powder or capital committed out looking for companies to buy. And what happens when you have competition is the prices being paid for companies starts to go up. You have moderate, you know, call it return thresholds being moderated because people are paying higher prices for companies, you know, in today's competitive PE world. And as a result of that, you certainly have winners and losers. Like any industry, if you've got 6,000 companies participating, there's good ones, there's mediocre ones, and there's some really bad ones, you know, who've been burned and made some bad investments. So yeah, sure, it runs the gambit anytime you have this much capital and this many firms investing it.
So who are the best private equity players out there, Adam?
Well, that's a loaded question. Going to get me in trouble here. I consult with many.
I'm trying.
You know, generally, when you think of the biggest private equity firms, names like Carlyle, Blackstone, Apollo, KKR, you know, are certainly names that exist out there. But size alone is nowhere near a determining factor in terms of good or bad. There are certainly some great firms and funds out there that invest in small companies. You know, I gave you an example. I built a company. The company I'm actually running today as CEO, first shareholders to hire me was Audix Private Equity. Audix over the last 20 years has grown very large. However, they never left their original knitting. You know, their specialty was lower middle market. Let's buy stuff that has EBITDA in the teens, take it up to EBITDA in the 50s, and then sell it. As funds got bigger over time, rather than buying bigger companies, they just put more investment professionals to work and they own more companies. So in the middle market, lower middle market space, you know, they're a firm that's particularly interesting from my perspective because they've been doing the same thing for so long. They're really good at it and identifying investments to make in the lower middle market and then getting outsized returns. Currently, my company is owned by Ares Management today. Ares Management is one of the world's largest non-bank lenders, $220 billion in assets under management. Another great firm. Really good stewards to the companies that they run, always giving outsized stock allocations to management and to line employees within the company. Another great firm. So I would tell you, it's not so much how big you are, because you can find good firms, great firms, bad firms, kind of at all sizes. And private equity firms typically tend to specialize, you know, in certain sized assets.
Well, you know, there's a illusion out there among the audience, private equity is like this bunch of rapacious guys. They come in, they do like Mitt Romney, they do asset stripping, sell off the valuable parts of the company and get more money than they paid. And then they go close up the factories and outsource it to China. How true is that stereotype?
You know, it's because of that stereotype that I wrote my first book, The Private Equity Playbook. I think that if you were to give a basic private equity quiz to a leadership, you know, to call it the executives in the United States, vast majority of people would flunk that because they really just don't have an in-depth understanding in private equity. My experience over 20 years is I buy companies, I build companies. Case in point, current company I'm running, when I got here, you know, roughly 1,400 employees, roughly $240 million in revenue. I'll cross $750, $800 million in revenue this year, over 3,000 employees. Typically, private equity-backed firms are growing at an outsized pace. You know, I'll take something that's growing in the single digits and try to get it to a compound annual growth rate of 30% or better and sustain it, which creates tons of jobs, tons of opportunities. So yeah, there's been some high profile companies really that had failed, if you think about the reason why they wound up selling to private equity in the first place, or just simply bad investments were made. Yes, some factories closed here or there, but that's not been my experience. And I don't think that's most people's actual experience if they spend any time working with private equity firms and funds. My experience is we build companies, we get very aggressive around growth, we make significant investments in people, in technology, and even in doing mergers and acquisitions in order to add capability or build density or expand businesses into new markets. So my experience working for over 20 years, you know, in private equity backed companies, very different than those kinds of examples that you highlighted, which unfortunately is what seems to make the news, because the news isn't about great things that happen. It's more about what kind of disaster can we find to talk about today? So,
because I look at a great brand, Neiman Marcus, right? Really the premier creme de la creme of upscale retailers by far, to the point where they have the nickname Needless Markup. And then they get bought out. They get bought out by a private equity company, strips them bare, loads them up with debt. And then the health issue comes along and they're forced to file for bankruptcy. But the private equity company got all their money out and they're happy and they don't care that they're closing stores, putting people out of work and all that. Sometimes, you know, some of these notorious private equity outfits really have a very exploitative business model, don't they?
Don't just survive. Thrive. The Financial Survival Network.
Arcana Corporation is on the verge of bringing the world's highest grade silver mine into production. The Revenue Virginius mine in Colorado has proven improbable silver reserves grading nearly 37 ounces per ton silver with an all-in sustaining production cost of only US $8 per ounce of silver. The mine is fully permitted with infrastructure already in place, and the company has announced they plan to commence production in 2020. Achieving successful production usually results in a significant upward share price re-rating on the Lassonde curve. Arcana trades under the ticker AUN in Toronto and AUNFF in New York. To learn more, go to arcana.com. That's AURCANA.com.
This is the Financial Survival Network, the information you need to thrive now more than ever.
Well, there's different kinds of private equity firms and funds. So sometimes there are funds that are called distressed asset funds, and their focus in life is to find distressed assets or companies that are in trouble and to essentially help them. You know, the attempt is to try to help them. But really, failures like you're talking about kind of are driven by the consumer. So, you know, what's dying in America today? Shopping malls. I'll tell you, the pandemic certainly didn't help that at all. But, you know, large box retail shopping malls, you know, it's interesting when you think of different things. You had local bookstores that were, you know, kind of interrupted by Borders books, and then Borders got interrupted by Amazon. And so I would tell you that it's kind of the American consumer or the international consumer who decides and picks winners and losers. And then what happens is you have companies that used to be winners become losers, and or changes in consumer habits sometimes drive outcomes. And it's not necessarily because a private equity sponsor or someone came in and made an investment in the space. Let me give you an example, too, when you mentioned leveraged debt. It's pretty typical for a private equity firm to have, you know, call it about half equity, half leverage, you know, when it comes to an investment. And certainly that's dictated by cash flows of a company. So is it over levered? Well, you'd have to take a look at something that people could, you know, who are listening could relate to. So let's use a house as an example. If a person buys a house and they use about 50% equity, and they take out a mortgage for about 50% of the balance on that house, people wouldn't think that that's over levered. They'd say, hey, I feel pretty good. I've got 50% equity in my house. And, you know, that's kind of a typical model. And I'll tell you, especially since the financial meltdown in 2008-09, you know, based on leverage rules and law changes, it gets difficult to over lever much beyond that in today's world of private equity. And as valuations have gone up, cash flow limitations also are putting people in a position to where there's far more equity invested in companies today than there is debt. And so I think that that dynamic has certainly changed over time.
Yeah, well, I agree with you there that limitations have come into place largely imposed by the market and by the people investing in the companies, because you've seen some spectacular blowups, particularly in real estate, retail. But the one thing that the can't deny that the companies often do when they take over a company, they're going to up the leverage on it. They're going to up the debt. And that is going to make the company much less able to sustain major shocks, as we've seen in the retail sector. So these were declining. It's a declining industry anyway. Then you're upping the debt on it. You're making it less nimble, less able to react, so that if the economy goes south, then basically they're only alternative is to file for bankruptcy or to seek a recapitalization, which oftentimes they've run out of time, like Neiman Marcus, like J. Crew, like Toys R Us.
Hey, Sears, Kmart, yeah. Bunch of retail disruption.
Sure.
Borders Books, Borders Books at its height, I think he had more than 40 to 50,000 employees. And thousands of retail stores, and Amazon has virtually wiped out Borders Books. Still some bricks and mortar out there, but few and far between, certainly from the height.
Yeah. Barnes and Noble, also a perfect example. So technology can cause these to be declining. I guess when they look at the company, they have to decide if it's had some down years, why has it had the down years? Shopping malls in general look like they're going the way of the pterodactyl there. It looks like they're kind of going extinct on us, all but the high-end discount outlet malls. But outside of them, the rest of them seem to be sucking wind.
People sure seem to be purchasing everything in the world online now. And I know even in my industry, a heavy part of my consumer base is grocery stores. We service tens of thousands of grocery stores all over the U.S. And, if people want to order diapers or dog food or Pop-Tarts, typically they're doing that online now. And in order to attract more customers into the stores, there's more square footage dedicated to fresh, prepared, frozen, which all feeds into my company, Coolsys, is, we keep stuff cold, certainly feeds into my wheelhouse. So I think there's a heavy evolution that's constantly going on. Something, though, you may not be aware of, we're talking about a few industries that have struggled. Private equity is involved virtually in every industry. It's hard to find an industry that private equity does not play in. Your largest veterinarian companies, your largest dental companies, pick an industry, any industry, and you'll find private equity is at work, although maybe not well known.
Okay, well, another thing, my objection to it, and it's not really because of private equity, it's because of all the regulations and everything. As a result, we've got a declining number of publicly traded companies. Now, maybe publicly traded companies are like the railroads. They've seen their day and they're going to diminish and, become extinct. But the point is that private equity has sped up that decline in the absolute number of publicly traded companies, thereby virtually ensuring that we're going to have a narrower and narrower stock market with more and more players chasing less and less companies, bidding them up. We've seen literally trillions of dollars of equity disappear from the publicly traded markets because they've gone into private equity. And I'm not saying that's good or bad, but I'm saying this is a trend that you really can't ignore. There's something like two-thirds of the publicly traded companies that there used to be, they've either gone out of business or gone private. And
do you think that's partially related to Sarbanes-Oxley and some of controls that have been put in place? It's so hard to take a company public now. Something that interests me just almost comically is this thing called SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies. So it's so hard to take a company public, and it takes so long, and the world is moving so fast. that, you know, people raise SPACs, which essentially is you take a company that does nothing public. It's easier to do, and you don't have to worry about time. You raise a bunch of money and then you decide what to buy. So for public investors, I call that, it's like a box of Cracker Jacks. You know, so you have to eat the Cracker Jack in order to know what the prize is at the bottom. And you know, if you invest in a SPAC, you're investing in something without knowing what the ultimate company is they're going to buy. And so you're seeing, you know, just in the last 12 months, hundreds of SPACs formed, hundreds of billions of dollars invested into them. So I think what you're speaking to is certainly a broader issue. Why is it so hard to take a company public, and why does it take so long, and why is it so risky that people aren't doing it? And it could be, you might have raised a point, which is because there's so much private capital out there, maybe it's the easier path, it's the easier route for folks to take. But it certainly does beg the question, why is it so hard to take a company public? Why does it take so long? And, you know, is it activist shareholders and litigation? Is it Sarbanes-Oxley? You know, certainly there's a lot of factors at play there.
Sure thing. And that kind of ties in with your new book coming out, The Exit Strategy Playbook, because it used to be the exit strategy was take your company public. Now the exit strategy is sell it off to private equity, right?
So in the exit strategy playbook, I kind of, private equity is certainly a piece of it, but in the first section of the book, I kind of explore the universe of buyers, and public is a piece of that. SPAC is a potential buyer and a piece of that, but selling to other owner operators is a piece of that. You know, in America, there's millions of small services businesses. Think of like dry cleaners or small dental practices or veterinarian practices. And oftentimes people used to bring in, a dentist would bring in a younger dentist and they'd work side by side for a few years. The old guy would wander off and the young guy would take over. And, you know, that, you know, so there's the owner operated shuffle that goes on. There is that path to public. And in my book, you know, I tend to discount public as the exit, primarily because I think people go public too early, and they're too small and they're too thinly traded. And I'd rather see, you know, a company with $1 billion in revenue going public than a company with $100 million in revenue. It gets very difficult when you're a small business or building a small empire. Certainly these aren't small businesses, but to go public is really geared towards big companies with, because of the complexity, because of the cost. And so the exit strategy playbook, we're all about, it's not just private equity. What are the other potential buyers in a business? And really, as an entrepreneur, how do I make those decisions? How do I think about different classes of buyers and potentially guide myself to the right place? Because most, let's face it, most entrepreneurs and owner operators have spent decades building businesses, but they only are going to do one sale. And it's kind of, they got close to retirement age or they're older, they've been doing it for a long time. And now they're a novice at selling a business, and they have one transaction to prepare for and rely on, and that's their own. And so again, I've bought and sold over 100 companies in my 20-year career. And as a result of that, I try to help people think through what are the different areas they should focus on, and how should they think about, you know, what's the right exit path?
All right. Well, hey, it's been an interesting discussion. We appreciate your coming on. And people want to find out more about you. Where should you go?
So adamecoffee.com is the easy place, and it's coffee, C-O-F-F-E-Y. People reach out to me on LinkedIn all the time too. Love hearing from listeners and people who have picked up and read the book. So it's, I love continuing to learn, and really, you know, my second book came from the first book because of feedback from readers asking me questions. And so that led to book number two. So love to hear from people. Don't be a stranger. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Hey, questions, comments for Adam? Just send an email to kl@carrylutz.com. Don't forget, go to the site, sign up for your free newsletter. Adam, pleasure. We'll talk to you again soon. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Carrie. Thanks to your listeners.
Thanks for listening to Carrie Lutz's Financial Survival Network, your solution to today's trying times. For the latest, go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com. Financial Survival Network. Now, more than ever.